Hi, everybody. It's Michael Bennett. I cannot thank you enough for taking time out of your day to join this call. I hope everybody's doing well and taking care of each other and themselves during this difficult time. Our goal with this call is to provide a brief update on the pandemic and the federal response, and then connect you with resources and do our best to answer questions. I've spent the morning on one call after another, the last of which was with Vice President Pence and the team at the White House that's working on this pandemic, and about 45 of my Democratic colleagues. So if there's anything we learned there or I learned there that will be of use to you, I'm happy to share it on this call. I also want to introduce a few others who are going to have a few words to say and be able to answer your questions, take your observations later. They've done this before last week, and it went extremely well. And so we put the cast back together again. We've got Dr. Mark Learned, the Vice President of Primary Care and Urgent Care at Kaiser Permanente, Colorado. Greg Stasinos from the Colorado Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response. Mark Chrisman from the Colorado Health Emergency Line for Public Information. And Jereen Peterson from Mile High United Way and 211 Colorado. After I speak and these guys speak, we're going to take your questions. If you have a question, please dial *3 on your phone. You can do that now. You don't need to wait for us to begin speaking. Again, please begin dialing *3 if you have a question. Right now, we're facing a challenge greater than any that we've seen since World War II. It is a massive public health crisis that called on all of us as Coloradans and Americans to do our part to try to mitigate this crisis. But the public health crisis, even as it is, has precipitated a massive economic crisis that's called for an unprecedented federal response. The first phase, which came in March, which seems like a lifetime ago, but really was just a couple of weeks ago, had $8.3 billion to expand testing and treatment. We were caught very flat-footed with this health crisis, and we've been trying to catch up ever since and to provide the testing that we need, not only to keep our frontline healthcare workers working on the front line, but also ultimately to allow us to together reopen this economy. We can talk more about that later. The second phase of legislation came just the following week in March, and it expanded paid sick leave, helped states administer unemployment, and did even more for testing. The third phase, which I know all of you have read about or maybe working on, was the massive $2.2 trillion package we passed 2 weeks ago to shore up our healthcare system and our economy. On the healthcare side, we included $150 billion to accelerate vaccines and treatments to replenish the national stockpile and to help hospitals and providers provide more equipment and write off more of their expenses and lost revenue. This morning I was on the phone with the administrator of HHS, Administrator Verma, talking about the rural hospitals in Colorado and how important it is for us to get those reimbursements out as fast as we can. You'll remember on the economic side of this package, we had direct cash payments of $1,200 a person and $500 a child for people making up to $75,000 and for couples making up to $150,000. For a typical family in Colorado, that's $3,400 in total support, enough for a lot of families to cover the rent and buy other necessities until we can provide even more relief. The point of that money is that it was supposed to come fast. I was on the phone with the commissioner of the IRS this morning, urging him to get the money out. He's working very hard to do that, and I'm grateful for that. We had much stronger unemployment insurance as part of this plan. In Colorado, the average benefit before that we passed this bill was $400 a week, and it lasted for 26 weeks. We've added another $600 per week on top of that, and we've extended the overall benefit by 13 weeks. For the first time, the benefit will cover contract workers, gig workers, and the self-employed, a change that we should have made some time ago. I'm glad we were able to make it together this time. I know everybody would rather be working. And we saw the unemployment numbers today across the country are just staggering. 12 or 13% of people unemployed is probably going to be higher than that. But to put it all together, the reforms to the unemployment insurance program means that tens of thousands of unemployed people in our state will get an average of $1,000 per week in support over the next several months. We also have included support for small business with $377 billion for loans and other relief to help small businesses cover their costs and keep their workers on their payroll. Put this in very practical terms, it means that small business can now get a loan from the federal government. The government will lend the money to the small business and then will forgive any money that's used by the small business to pay their employers for up to 2 months. It will also forgive some more for small businesses for critical expenses like rent and utilities. As an aside, I didn't think we should cap the amount at about $350 billion. I think that was a mistake, a short-sightedness of the bill, and I hope we have the opportunity to go back and fix that problem. At a broader level, just to give you a sense of, you know, what the scale is, when you talk about $2.2 trillion, it was the largest emergency spending bill in American history, and it still wasn't enough given the challenges that we face. It is remarkable that we passed it unanimously with 96 votes in the Senate. Everybody that was there voted for the bill. We normally, as you know, can't even pass name a post office in a single week. I think it is a recognition on both sides of the aisle that we had to act urgently and comprehensively. And I hope that we can go forward and proceed with the same sense of urgency because our work is not over. I'll be brief about this and then turn it over to my colleagues on the call. To start with, we still have to implement the first three bills. Given how quickly they came together, we know there are things that are going to need to be fixed. As this massive bill gets implemented, we've got to stay on top of the federal agencies to make sure they're being responsive and getting the money out the door to families and small businesses that can't afford to wait. We've got to start thinking about priorities for the next package as well. And I bring all of that up to emphasize that as this whole process unfolds, we want to hear from you about what's working, what's not working, what we convey to the people in Washington that are administering the programs. And as we think about what should come next, we also want to hear from you about what we need to prioritize. I've already sent to the leadership in both the House and the Senate a set of priorities, which we certainly can add to and amend, but mostly it's about getting more money to our families, to state, small businesses, state and local governments, and to our hospitals. And you don't have to wait for these calls. You can connect with me either by calling my Denver office at 303-455-7600 or by going to our website, which has a number of resources as well you might find helpful. With that, I'm going to turn it over to our panelists. Before Dr. Learned starts, I want to remind you to dial *3 to ask your questions while our panelists are sharing some brief remarks, and then we'll take your questions for the balance of the hour. Dr. Learned, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Senator Bennett. My name is Mark Learned. I'm the Vice President of Primary Care for Kaiser Permanente and of Urgent Care. I'm a primary care internal medicine doctor by training, and I just want to share with you some introductory comments on sort of the biology and some medical information about this virus. And my disclaimer is I'm giving you the best information I have right now, but as we heard from Senator Bennett, this stuff changes really fast. So we're learning every day, and sometimes that changes our advice, but I'm going to tell you the best information that I know right now. Coronaviruses are not new. We see coronaviruses every cold and flu season, and they cause cough and fever and things. This particular coronavirus is new and different and is more infectious than the average coronavirus, and that's really what's causing the problem. It's more infectious than regular seasonal flu. It's actually slightly more infectious than Ebola even. It's on a par with what was called the Spanish flu, which was an influenza outbreak of 1918. And if you're not a medical infectious disease historian, and I don't know why you wouldn't be, I would encourage you to Google the Spanish flu and just read about it. What the world went through in 1918 is very similar to what we're going through right now, and there's a lot to be learned there. This virus can cause a lot of different symptoms. Fever and cough are the classic ones, followed by shortness of breath. And it's mainly transmitted by droplets. It's not an airborne disease, which is a fine point, but an important point. Diseases like measles and tuberculosis are fantastically more contagious than even this because their particles are so small, they can float in the air. This is not like that. Coronavirus is transmitted via droplets. So when someone coughs or sneezes, they produce droplets which are heavy and which fall out of the air relatively quickly. We think they can travel about 6 feet, and that's why the social distancing recommendations are to maintain a distance of 6 feet, because we think that's about as far as this virus can fly. The social distancing policies that have been put into place are critical, and they're really the only good weapon we have against the spread of this virus. We know that if you live your regular life and you're infected, you will go on to infect over 400 people in the span of a month. But with the kinds of social distancing measures we've put into place, that number falls to only 2.5 people in a month. And that's really the efforts that are starting to pay off. We have several days of optimism of reducing rates of people passing from this infection, and I can go into that in more detail later in the talk if people are interested. I'll finish with, what should you do if you get sick? Well, of course, if you're having a medical emergency, you're going to call 911. If you're sick, but it's not an emergency and you're not sure what to do, I want you to contact your doctor before you show up in their office. Kaiser Permanente has a pretty robust virtual offering. You can email, you can text us, you can chat us on your phone app, you can call us. Whatever your provider offers, I want you to take advantage of that and stay home unless it's clear that you need an office visit. 80% of people who contract this infection will have a frustrating course of feeling bad, but they won't need the hospital. They need Tylenol and fluid and rest and to be isolated to prevent the spread of the disease. So contact your physician before coming to the office and try to protect that office and yourself. Senator Bennett.
Thanks a lot, Mark. I really appreciate. Actually, maybe, well, when we get to the questions, I'd love it if you could give us some of that data that you were talking about. I think people would be really interested to hear it. But now I'll turn it over to Greg Stassinos. Greg?
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you again, Senator Bennett, for inviting me to this forum. My name is Greg Stassinos. On a daily basis, I'm the Operations and Response Section Chief for the Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. But currently, I've been reassigned to the State Emergency Operations Center, and I'm the Deputy Incident Commander within the Public Health and Medical Operations Branch. And what we're doing is we're currently supporting the State Emergency Operations Center in preparing for any sort of medical surge that our hospitals will be seeing or are actually seeing right now. We're trying to allocate certain resources for them, such as personal protective equipment and other supplies. And we're working to establish alternate care sites in the event that the hospitals would need those extra beds to help decompress their medical surge. So again, I want to thank Senator Bennett for the invite and looking forward to the conversation.
Great, thanks, Greg. And now we got Mark Chrisman. Mark.
Thank you, Senator Bennett, and thank you all for coming together here today. My name is Mark Chrisman. I'm a supervisor at Rocky Mountain Poison Center, part of Denver Health, and I oversee the public health hotline called COHELP, the Colorado Health Emergency Line for Public Information, as you said. Our team's available 7 days a week. We answer calls from the public and occasional healthcare providers. A lot of roads point to COHELP, so you find our number pretty much everywhere. We use the specific guidance prepared by the experts, Greg's team at State Health Department, and the different epidemiology experts. Our aim is we're going to share the consistent messaging to the public regarding the event at hand. And if we don't have that information, we're guiding them to other resources. We do offer language interpretation, so we're going to serve callers in their preferred language at no cost. Now, we're not a medical advice line. We do share recommendations provided by the experts. So in the case of COVID-19, of course, stay home if you're sick. Don't go to the emergency department for minor symptoms or call ahead if you need medical attention so you're not infecting the waiting room, advice like that. If people don't have a doctor, they're uninsured, underinsured, we'll try to help them find a provider in their area. access a nurse advice line and make those health decisions. Top questions the past couple weeks, certainly, should I get tested or where should I be tested, followed by, you know, essential business questions, who should be closed, who should be open. And, you know, we're starting to hear a lot of questions about antibody testing, looking for previous undiagnosed exposures or convalescent plasma donation. So there's a lot of people, you know, trying to learn more. In summary, CoHelp aims to relay public health facts and standard messaging to general public, all prepared by the national, state, or local experts. And in turn, we feed our data back to CDPHE so their team can better understand what questions the public have and meet the public's need for information more quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And Jereen is going to close it out, and then we'll take your questions. Remember, you can press star 3 and get in the queue. Jereen?
Thank you, Senator Bennett. My name is Jereen Peterson, and I'm the Chief Impact Officer for Mile High United Way, and we oversee the 211 call center in the Denver metro area. And 211 is also a statewide call number that anyone can call that need health or human services. So as you would call 911 in an emergency, you would call 211 when you're looking for help with rental assistance, when you're looking for help for utility assistance, child care, food resources, mental health services. You can call 211 and there will be an operator there to speak with you directly Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Or if you'd like to check out the website and just search for services in your local area, you can also go to the website, which is 211colorado.org, and see one of any 7,500 resources statewide to help people in this time. And I think what I want to encourage people to do is not to be shy or afraid to ask for help right now. This is the time that help is there and available for you. And so please don't hesitate to call and talk to an operator or go on the website. But please do call if you need assistance. Thank you, Senator Bennett.
Thank you very much, Jereen. And with that, Alexandra, I'm going to turn it over to you to moderate the questions.
Great. Our first question today is from Robert from Castle Rock. Robert, your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hello, Senator Bennett. My name is Robert Yoakum. I'm from Castle Rock. Thank you for all of your efforts to help stem this pandemic. I have two questions, actually. One is for your panel, specifically Dr. Learned and his colleagues in the insurance industry and the healthcare industry. What is going to be done to provide the serology test once it's available to everyone in Colorado and beyond so that they can determine whether or not they have been exposed to the disease? I myself have elderly parents in their upper 80s. I cannot visit them. I cannot tend to them. All I have is phone calls. I need to know whether or not I can see them. I'm a researcher at Johns Hopkins. That's one of my concerns. And the second question is for you, Senator Bennett. What is being done in the Senate and the legislature to stem the disease worldwide in poorer countries? There was a New York Times article today stating that the richer countries in the world are hoarding all of the resources. And as you know, Senator, if we don't tamp down and destroy this disease worldwide, it's not going to go away. We're going to have an incidence, as Dr. Leonard said, like the 1918 plague, when it seems to go away and then it resurfaces again. Thank you.
Dr. Leonard, please take it. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Boy, there's a lot in that question. So trying to address the testing questions first, you know, as we well know, there's a nationwide shortage of both testing supplies to gather the samples, reagents with which to process the samples, and facilities and trained personnel to perform the test. We are seeing improvement on that in Colorado already. It is still the PCR test, so this is a test that looks for viral DNA and RNA, not the antibody test. I think we're in a place with many things with coronavirus where our desires to use things that aren't fully developed is outstripping our understanding of them. So, for example, there's debate as to whether or not an antibody test can accurately predict your level of immunity. And so, unfortunately, I don't have a solid answer for you about using the antibody test to then predict, because I think what our caller was interested in is to know whether or not he had antibodies, whether or not perhaps his parents had antibodies, therefore whether or not it's safe for them to get back together. And I don't have a test that I'm confident can answer that question yet. The resourcing question, I think, falls more to your realm, Senator Bennett, but I will say that the caller is absolutely correct that this is going to be a stubborn and frustrating virus to stamp out. And while we won't have to maintain these kind of severe social distancing and shelter at home measures indefinitely, it's not unlikely that we would see this virus have some kind of resurgence with cold and flu seasons in coming years, because short of a vaccine, it's going to be very hard to eradicate this virus, and we're probably at least 12 to 18 months away from a vaccine.
I really don't have much to add to that, but I'll say a couple things. Since you're a researcher for Johns Hopkins, I want to say how much I appreciate the work that Johns Hopkins is doing on this. It's really, I've been on the phone with those guys a number of times, and they really are taking global leadership, so I appreciate that. And I'm just going to be completely candid. Right now, when we get on a phone call with the administration, when we've got a bunch of senators on the call, what we're having a conversation about is how do we have the kind of equipment that Dr. Learned is talking about and says it's getting better, the personal protective equipment. How do we make sure that New York has what they need, but when Colorado needs it, that it's there for Colorado and New Mexico? And this has been a work in progress, to say the least. The administration now has an admiral that they've stood up to try to handle the logistics of making sure that that we've got supplies everywhere, because the same thing that you asked about globally could happen in America if we don't have, or in the United States, if we don't all take the social distancing seriously. In all the states, we risk, you know, having a situation where we open the economy, then we close, then we open, then we close. You can't build a wall against a virus. Internationally and globally, once we get our act together here, which I hope is going to happen in the coming months, you're absolutely right. There's nobody to lead but the United States here, really, at least in an open and transparent way. And we have got to collaborate with our alliances around the world, which we've got to rebuild in the wake of some of what's happened over the last decade or so. And maybe putting my optimistic hat on, the coronavirus gives us a reason to remember why the international order that we have and relationships that we have are so important.
The next question is from Jeff from Windsor. Jeff, your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question. Jeff, if you're there, your line is now unmuted.
Question for Senator Bennett.
Yes,
I'm here, Jeff. How are you?
Thank you. So my question is in regards to the mortgages. I know that the CARES Act had a provision in there for federally backed mortgages, but the fraction that are not federally backed is anywhere from a third to a half. Historically, I think the default rate on mortgages had been around 2 or 3% before the 2008 crash. The 2008 period, that ramped up somewhat slowly to 8 to 10, and that basically brought the mortgage industry to its knees. But what we're talking about now is something that's ramping up in, you know, a few weeks and could be as high as like 30% of mortgages go into default. And I think this is going to turn into a pretty cataclysmic crisis very quickly. And I'm wondering what's going to be done because we don't have the luxury of time. Everybody owes everybody else. And right. Even if everybody went back to work today, there's still going to be this very hard ripple that goes through the mortgage industry.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point. And, you know, it's interesting that the cause of the recession couldn't be more different than the one the last time, and yet the mortgage industry and mortgage owner, holders are getting completely whacked by this. Let me back up to 300,000 feet and say, ideally, we would figure out a way to freeze the economy for the period of time we're in this, so that, you know, if I've got debts payable, but somebody else owes me, we'd freeze all of that and we just carry through until the coronavirus was done. We haven't been able to find an imaginative way to do that. We tried to do it in bits and pieces. You're 100% right that we put in place prohibitions on foreclosures and evictions across federally backed mortgages and federally reported supported rental properties, but not others. And we would have made it broader, but for other mortgages or rental properties, there was a worry about legal challenges to doing so at the federal level. And as an alternative, a number of counties and cities in Colorado have put in place a broader-based moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, which is a critical pause to help a catastrophe of people losing their home through no fault of their own at the worst possible time. In addition to the bill we did pass, we focused on providing direct assistance to people in an effort to try to help them pay their bills. We included relief for renters and people facing eviction in the last bill, about $7 billion. But I worry that that won't be near enough. And for all these reasons, I sent a letter earlier this week to the leadership of the Senate and the House. We're going to be negotiating the next package with some priorities for Colorado, and a major part of that will be additional support for renters and for homeowners. One thing that's important here is that landlords and banks who are making mortgage loans have expressed support for this assistance because they know they need people to be able to pay the rent or mortgage during this difficult time, and I think that's a recognition that we're all in this together. Hopefully the expansions to unemployment benefits and direct payments will help people in the short term pay their mortgages. And I agree with you that we really don't have a moment to lose. We're trying to address the issue on all fronts. In the meantime, we need to make sure the regulators are not counting a 1 month delay in payment against the banks so that the banks can actually be lenient with the mortgagers. So let's stay in touch on this. And in a minute, I'll give you my office number so that if you have mortgage trouble, you can call me and get that number. Alex?
The next question is from Sue from Greeley. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Thank you, Senator Bennett. I'm Sue from Greeley. I wanted to thank you and your caring professional team for sharing all your expertise. We're really grateful, I think all of us, for legitimate, reliable, fact-based information. And I just also have to say that I channel the essence of your brilliant 24th of January 2019 rant multiple times a day, now more than ever. But in any case, my primary concern is Trump's exploitation of the suffering that's related to the pandemic for his personal gain. It's impacting all Americans, and we have some local examples of how it's impacting Coloradoans. First of all, the shortage of test kits seems to be by design, because this is a person who fears data and science so that he can create his own reality. I suspect that the numbers are much greater than what we're seeing, and maybe one of your panelists can address that. My second concern is our very good friend has been taking hydroxychloroquine for a lupus-related condition for over 8 years, and she was just advised by her provider that the drug will now no longer be available to people who are prescribed, for whom it is prescribed. We want to know why. It's not a coincidence. We also understand that Trump promised 500 ventilators to Colorado and only delivered on 100. And my last point has to do with my concern, all of our concern over the firing of Glenn Fine. And so now wondering what kind of, how effective will congressional oversight alone be in managing the adjudication of the CARES Act?
So let me, thank you. That's a ton of questions. I want to make sure that Dr. Learned has the chance to answer the hydroxychloroquine question, because I'm not an expert at that, but I'd love it if you would take that. Let me take a few of the others that that you mentioned. One, the way we set this statute up was so there'd be congressional oversight based on an inspector general that was selected by the other inspectors general in the government. And President Trump unfortunately fired the person that they selected, who was the very well-respected Inspector General at the Defense Department. I am deeply worried about what that means for congressional oversight, and we are having conversations together about about how to make sure we've got the oversight, both on the healthcare side and on the economic side. You know, we've got a small business program that's running right now, and we got to make sure that it's not just the people that are most connected to the big lenders that are having the benefit of that, but everybody is having the benefit of that, including in rural areas of the state where sometimes it's harder to find that kind of support. On the ventilators, I couldn't be more sure that we didn't get the ones that we were promised by FEMA, and we have to keep fighting for that. And it's been good to see the governors begin to cooperate with each other across the country to try to make sure that we have some sort of opportunity in place to be able to move the ventilators where they're needed at the time they're needed with some, you know, not complete precision, but with some predictability about what we're facing. Unfortunately, really up until this point, we've been in a situation where governors and states and even hospitals, even the VA hospitals themselves, are having to compete against each other to get the equipment that's needed. And the result of that is we've been driving up prices and reducing and increasing scarcity of equipment, which is exactly the opposite of what we would want to do. I asked that very question today of the vice president and the admiral that they've got assigned to work on this. And he said to me that they have a pipeline of equipment that's coming from overseas to begin to fulfill the backlog that we have. It wasn't on ventilators, but equipment for the frontline healthcare workers. So we have to stay after it. I will put the testing question aside, except to say we desperately need a test so that we are able to do all the things we have to do to be able to open up the government again. I think, you know, I have some hope that, and maybe the doctor can address this too, that's going to come sooner rather than later, but it certainly can't come soon enough. Dr. Learned, would you like to take the hydroxychloroquine question? I get asked this a lot as I'm wandering around, but I don't have the credentials to give real medical advice.
Yeah, happy to. I had to practice saying that medicine name many times when I was in school.
You're nice to say that.
I'll talk just briefly about the testing question first. So absolutely true. We are not testing the number of people we wish we could, and there are more cases, therefore, than we are able to document. I will say that the predictive data that's being done by the IHR and others is based on mortality. It's based on people who are dying of respiratory illness. And so we're writing those down as coronavirus deaths. And you know, that's pretty easy, right? Either you died or you didn't. And so that data is probably pretty good. It might even be just slightly overstated, because a few of those cases are probably actually influenza and not coronavirus. And if you didn't get tested, you wouldn't know that, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. But the predictions and the data around when the surge will come and when the peak will come is based on deaths, and therefore we trust it more than we trust sort of reports just of cases. I alluded to some optimism in my opening comments, and maybe I'll address that right now. So in Colorado, we've had several days of declining death rates. And so to be clear, you know, we still have people passing away from this infection. We still have new cases being documented every day. But for several days in a row now, each day we've had fewer deaths. that tells us that we might be approaching the peak and that we might actually be in the surge. And if that's true, that's a real victory story for social distancing. But number one, it's a little too early to tell. We need, you know, remember the incubation period of this virus is 2 weeks long. And so really, the data that we have from today is really generated 14 days ago and is now coming to fruition, right? So we have kind of think about a two-week lag in those predictions. Number one and number two, you alluded to this already, Senator, but what we would hate to do is declare victory too soon, open things up, and then experience what China did, which is a second, more severe peak, and then you have to close everything back down again. What we know from pandemic data from history is you do less economic damage if you do it once, and if you do it for a little longer on the front end, and then you're truly done, that's better for the community and for the economy than if you open prematurely and then have to close again. So those would all be my comments on sort of the data and the testing piece. Hydroxychloroquine, as the caller alluded to, is a medicine that's used in a number of immune conditions, and I believe the caller's friend had lupus. I am not aware of any sort of ban or anything like that that is preventing doctors from continuing to prescribe hydroxychloroquine to patients who need it for an FDA-approved indication like lupus. I can tell you at Kaiser Permanente, we've put into place policies that prevent our doctors from prescribing it in the outpatient setting. The data is really mixed as to whether this medicine helps with coronavirus. And when I say that, what I mean is we have several very small studies, some of which suggest it's helpful and some of which suggest it isn't. And that just means we don't know the answer yet. So we should think of this as an experimental medicine. And we know the way we're using it at Kaiser Permanente is really in severely ill patients who are in the hospital and on the ventilator and kind of need a Hail Mary. Well, then we'll try this, understanding that we don't understand the benefit and that we do know that it can be toxic to liver and kidneys and other things. But I don't know of any reason that a patient who controls their lupus with hydroxychloroquine would need to stop. That's certainly not something that we're doing. And so I would encourage the caller's friend to have a conversation with their doctor about what they meant. Did they mean that this pharmacy was out? Is the doctor under some misleading impression that he's not allowed to prescribe it, which my understanding would be is false? Some details there that should be explored.
Thank you, doctor. Alex?
Our next question is from Ruth from Colorado Springs. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Colorado Springs, and I want to thank Senator Bennett for having these town hall meetings on the phone. It makes me feel good. Anyway, I'd like to know how we're going to pay for all of these trillion-dollar stimulus packages that are being passed.
I am so grateful for that question, Ruth. Thank you very much for asking it. You know, we're in a moment, given the fact that we're now roughly 12 or 13% unemployment. The entire economy has been momentarily shattered by an event that's completely outside the economic control, certainly, of anybody that's in our economy. Our state and local governments have lost half or more of their revenue, and keeping very basic services flowing is going to be difficult. And millions and millions and millions of Americans are unemployed, and businesses, as you know, are closed. So I believe this is a moment where we have to spend money in order to recover, in order for our economy to recover, because if we don't, I think we'll pitch into a depression that's going to be much worse to recover from. But this is happening in a context, and it's important for people to understand that context. You know, the answer to the question is, how are we paying for it? We're not. We're borrowing the money, mostly borrowing the money from the Chinese. And we are not in a good position to be doing this. It's really important for people to understand this. The last 20 years, we have borrowed $5.6 trillion from the Chinese to fund the wars that we've had in the Middle East. We didn't pay for any of that money. We borrowed it all. In fact, not only did we not pay for it, we cut the taxes mostly on the wealthiest Americans while we were at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, a staggering level of irresponsibility in my judgment. Since 2001, if you add up those tax cuts, we have borrowed from the Chinese $5 trillion to give tax cuts to the wealthiest people in America. It makes no sense to me. It'd be like, if you think about it in the context of Colorado Springs, it'd be like John Southers, who's the mayor there, and I know John well, and he would never do this. But can you imagine if John Southers said, we're going to borrow more money than Colorado Springs has ever borrowed before, and you would say, that worries me. What are you going to spend the money on? And if he said, I'm not going to spend it on infrastructure, I'm not going to spend it on schools, I'm not going to spend it on health care, I'm not going to spend it on mental health care, not going to spend it on water infrastructure or preparing us for a pandemic. And you'd say, well, what are you going to spend the money on? He said, well, I'm going to give it to the two wealthiest neighborhoods in Colorado Springs. You'd say, you are insane. But that is what we have done with $5 trillion since 2001. That's what Donald Trump did with his $1.5 trillion tax cut that he said was for the middle class, and now we're on our knees. So we were at a moment when this pandemic hit us, when our unemployment rate was actually low. Our stock market was doing well, but our deficit was continuing to scream through the roof because of how irresponsible we have been. And I think we've got to get through this moment. We've got to spend this money now. On the back end of this, I believe very strongly that we have to start investing in our country again. And when we're borrowing money, we ought to be using it to invest in our country again, not to loot the treasury for the benefit of just a few Americans. And we've got to find a way back to some fiscal sanity. If you're really bored during this pandemic, you can get my book, which is called The Land of Flickering Lights, on Amazon. And there's a chapter on this stuff, and I describe this as a theft of the next generation in that book. So let's talk about that more after this is over. For the moment, we've got to do what we can to keep us afloat, and let's go to the next question.
Our next question is from Philip from Longmont. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hello, Senator Bennett. Thank you for doing this today, and the panel also. We own a small business, and small businesses of all kinds are really hurting right now. And we have attempted to get onto the Paycheck Protection Program, and we just run into walls. You know, that there are banks who are saying, "Oh, we're just going to take our customers who have an account with us, et cetera, et cetera." And it leads me to two questions. One question is there any plan being developed to communicate in a centralized way to all of us out here who, you know, really need this financial assistance, and have no idea when, you know, it might arrive and how we can get help? And part two of the question is, at this point, when do you expect that things like the $1,200 cash payment will be received by folks? Because at this point, I think there's a big communication breakdown, and there would be a lot less anxiety out there if we all really knew what was going on.
Yeah. I could not agree with you more, and I appreciate you raising it. We're building this a little bit on the fly. It might come to my center office and say, we're doing what we can to try to provide information, but this was one of the conversations I had this morning with the IRS commissioner, was on the importance of getting that direct payment out as fast as possible. And what he said to me is that $1,200 payment should be coming as soon as next week, if you have direct deposit information with the IRS, which you probably do if you're a small business owner. There are others in the society that I think should have been able to get that money through the electronic benefit transfer payments that we have. We haven't been able to stand that up yet. But he said next week for the $1,200. He's got more complicated issues with the $500 for minors that he's trying to work through. And if you've not provided that direct deposit information, people are going to have to go online to enter that information. And so if you haven't already done that, you can check with irs.gov to get that information. And you should check back there every couple of days. I'm sorry that it's not more seamless than that, but it's not more seamless than that. And I, by the way, agree with you that I think that if people could get those direct payments, what they were meant to do was be a bridge to the unemployment. Please also, you can visit my website. It's Bennett, B-E-N-N-E-T, just one T, .senate.gov. We've got a guide for workers, families, and businesses with information on the various programs in the CARE Act and the other legislation that we've passed. If you're struggling to sort through programs, including the PPP program, please call my state office at 303-455-7600. We are available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If we're not actually there, we're virtually there. And we will call you back as soon as we can. I have worried a lot about this issue of banks only lending to people that they have pre-existing relationships with. I'm worried about family-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, rural businesses. These are conversations that we're having. When I say we, I mean those of us that are senators that are interested in this kind of stuff, with the Treasury Department to make sure that this goes back to the oversight question that was asked earlier, to make sure that the money is actually being directed in the way it was intended to be, which is to the businesses that need it most, which is a lot of small businesses that don't have pre-existing relationships. They can put them in, and I will say, as critical as I've been of President Trump over the years, part of this is just the difficulty of setting up something this new and this large. And I think that the guidance went out last Friday from Treasury, and they're trying to, you know, continue to do the work now. It's Thursday, and I hope things will get better over time. But if you get stuck, call my office at 303-455-7600. We can't guarantee success, but we certainly can guarantee that we will try. There, on the website, there's also links to appropriate agency websites for health information, tax information, business support information, and what we've tried to do is provide resources based on the questions that we've had, like yours, and hopefully they're responsive as a result. But thank you for that. The question you have is on the mind of a lot of people in the country.
Our next question is from Christopher from Colorado Springs. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Thank you, Senator Bennett, for taking the phone call. My name is Christopher Graham, and I'm curious about the if you get the website for the contractors and unemployment benefits, and also how is this going to affect churches and social religious programs, especially coming up this Easter weekend.
So thanks a lot, Christopher, for that question. I'm going to start with the question of independent contractors, and then I'll come back to the religious question. I just want to make it clear, because some people may not have been on the call at the very beginning, that we expanded unemployment benefits to contractors as part of this bill, also to gig workers, the self-employed, and other workers with 1099 income. I think that's really important because it reflects the economy as it really is, not as the federal programs are designed. Since this is a new program, the unemployment insurance program with respect to contractors, the state of Colorado's unemployment office needs federal guidance on how to set it up. And we've been pushing really hard for the Department of Labor and Treasury from the feds to get that guidance out as quickly as possible. We sent a couple letters on that issue and asked for assistance to help them get it up to speed quickly. We don't have the guidance yet, and I'm told it's going to take a while, a few weeks, to set it up. So the emergency is really immense here. The good news is that you are eligible for the new federal benefit, not only after you get approved, but as soon as you get approved. And I hope that's going to help. The other thing I want to mention to you in the context of the question that we had before is that if you filed taxes for 2019 or 2018 and you've got direct deposit information with the IRS, you'll likely be getting your $1,200 direct payment, which is in addition to the unemployment benefit, as early as next week. So I hope that all helps. The other thing is, if you are unable to work, when you get approved, you're going to be eligible not just from that moment, but back to the point when you were unable to work, or March 29th, whatever is later. So you'll have a back benefit as well, as will the employees of all the businesses out there that have lost people. On religious organizations, Governor Polis put out guidance to make sure that churches and mosques and others have services if they want as drive-throughs, and making sure that they're listening to social distancing guidelines. This is really important because this week and this weekend specifically is critical for so many of our community members who have religious holidays. Passover is going on right now, and although there's guidance on how to have these services and meetings through video, I think it is also true that there's a lot of religious organizations across the country that have been distributing ideas of their own to make sure that people are can worship together and at the same time stay safe, which it really is vitally important. I think the governor struck the balance in the right place. He's got a really tough job at this moment. I think on that question, he did well.
The next question is from Joan from Arvada. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Yes, Joan from Arvada. To any of the experts, squelching a rumor about confiscation of ventilators or other Coloradans who own or who rent their ventilators in an effort to free up supplies at hospitals, are they allowed to take their ventilators? Or, you know, what has been discussed about that as far as Coloradans sort of assisting hospitals to free up those supplies? What can any of your experts tell us about this?
Let me turn that over to the experts. Could you ask the question again? I'm sorry. I think we may have surprised our folks unfairly, but please go ahead.
All right. To perhaps either of any of the experts, having to do with squelching a rumor about confiscation of ventilators should they have COVID-19 and be in the hospital. And the second part is, if they rent their own and they are allowed or denied by emergency workers to bring it along with them, would it be confiscated? Or address Coloradans' issues, hey, we have our own ventilators, would it be of any help to free up the supplies that hospitals have?
I think I can.
I wonder, Dr. Learned or Greg, if you'd like to, yeah, please.
Yeah, it's Dr. Learned. So I'm going to answer this two ways. I'm not sure we're using ventilator to mean the same thing. So it would be quite rare for someone to own or rent a ventilator. If you're on a mechanical ventilator, such as we're talking about, which is an ICU device that breathes for you, almost always the patient has to be either intubated or have a tracheostomy, a hole in the front of their throat where the tube goes in and down into their lungs. It's a very serious medical intervention, and typically people who are on ventilators would be in long-term care facilities. They wouldn't be able to be at home without 24-hour nursing support. I wonder if the caller is talking about other kinds of breathing support machines like CPAP or BiPAP machines that are sometimes used for sleep apnea. And so I'll answer both ways. I have not heard anything that would indicate the government would go into a long-term care facility and take a ventilator to use in the ICU. And the CPAP and other kinds of breathing support machines that private citizens might have wouldn't be helpful for that circumstance anyway. So I think my answer is a pretty confident no, acknowledging that I'm not sure I fully understood the question.
Greg, did you have anything you wanted to add? Or
So I can, give a little background on how we're at Great. The State Emergency Operations Center are working to increase our levels or amounts of ventilators. Obviously, we're working with private entities, private companies that do manufacture ventilators, and basically as a state buying those outright to see if we can increase our cache of ventilators in Colorado. And secondly, we have put out messages to veterinarians and dentists if they are willing to part with their ventilators, which are obviously medical grade, but we just have to figure out if they would be adequate to increase our cash. So that's the way we're looking at it, and we're processing those orders as best we can, so that we can have the adequate amount if we do see this surge actually develop to an overwhelming standard.
Thank you. You know, we've been facing this shortage since the very beginning of this crisis. We now have companies even in Colorado that are proposing to switch over what they do to be able to build ventilators. So we're looking for resources everywhere. But the most important thing we can all do is the social distancing and that we've been told we need to do, because if we do that, we can keep the number of people that are infected down. That will keep the number of people that are getting sick down, and that will keep the number of people that are in hospitals and then need ventilators down. So it's sort of there's two things going on at once. One is, can we find the ventilators we need to deal with the surge? And at the same time, can we try to keep the surge as low and as late as possible so that we can buy time and buy space so that we actually have the ventilators that we need? And as Dr. Learned said, we are making some progress, which is not a reason to stop this social isolation. It actually to keep the social distancing. It means we need to keep doing it because we are making gains, and every gain we make is a ventilator or two that we're not going to have to find somewhere else.
This will be our final question this afternoon. We have Connor from Boulder. Your line is now unmuted. Please introduce yourself and ask your question.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all for your time this afternoon. My question is for Senator Bennett. I'm curious if you could speak a little bit more to your key priorities for the next legislative package, and also to the extent that you feel comfortable commenting on it, the timing of what that package could be, given any political considerations.
Sure. Thanks, Connor. It's a great question to end on, and I appreciate everybody being on the call. I sent a letter, which you can find on my website, to Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi a few days ago. I guess it was on Tuesday, largely the product of calls like this, urging them to include key Colorado priorities in any future legislative package Congress considers in response to COVID-19. I won't go through all of it, but the letter outlined key reforms to the CARES Act, such as much-needed fixes and additional funding to the Paycheck Protection Program. I think it was Philip in Fort Collins that mentioned the issues that he's having. That's the small business program. It's because I've heard from people like him that were saying we gotta make it better. I also called for new funding to relieve state and tribal and local governments, because the calls I've had with county commissioners all over our state and with mayors and with school superintendents is showing me that we've got a lot more to do there. For months and months and months, I've been leading the effort on funding for rural hospitals and providers who are in the front lines. Senator Barrasso from Wyoming and I have been leading that call. We put a letter out together that led to this call this morning with Administrator Verma to say that our rural hospitals are in desperate shape. You know, we had a record closure of rural hospitals last year in the U.S. as it was. The danger is we might lose more than twice as many this year, and so we're focused on that. I also emphasized in the letter the plan that I've had with 19 other senators to increase and strengthen the direct cash assistance efforts to Americans through this crisis and their kids until the economy heals after the crisis. And so those are some of the things that I've been focused on. And if anybody on this call has other ideas, please call 303-455-6004 7600. The second question was about timing, which is really, really important, and I'm glad you asked it. You may have, any of you reading today, the newspapers will have seen that Mitch McConnell went to the floor with a proposed version to try to get what's called unanimous consent on a proposal. That failed. The Democrats had one proposal. That failed. We're having to do it by unanimous consent because we're not in Washington to vote, and Senator McConnell has said that he won't allow remote voting for the Senate. I don't know whether that's a good idea or not, but it makes it hard to get the work done. And I can't predict when it's going to happen. This could come together in a day or two or a week or a month. In the meantime, we've got to implement what we are doing with as much fidelity as possible so that the people that most need the help get it, and businesses and workers can get back up on their feet on the one hand, and on the other hand, that we're doing what we need to do on the healthcare side of things so that we can open, you know, sooner rather than later and without the risk of having a rolling wave of economic closures, which is would be a disaster for our economy, and I think is unnecessary based on what we've seen through history and around the world, as long as we're disciplined about what we need to do. You know, every now and then you're going to see something that looks like partisan politics back there, and I apologize for that because it's too bad that happens. On the other hand, you know, the last proposal that we had from Mitch McConnell before this ended was a $1 trillion proposal. We spent 36 hours continuing to negotiate, even as he kept saying, you know, it's shameful that you're not voting on the proposal. Well, the proposal that we ended up voting on was a $2 trillion proposal, not the $1 trillion proposal that Mitch McConnell had proposed, with important aid to our state and local governments and more than twice as money for our hospitals and frontline healthcare workers. So, you know, I'm the first to complain when the rancor is useless back in D.C. I can say it feels not useless when you've doubled the package at a moment of this kind of economic dislocation, and in the end when 96 senators voted for it as a sign of, you know, ultimately the bipartisan effort that it was. So I appreciate everybody's question today, and as we come to the end here, I wanted to see whether our panelists wanted to have a last word as well. Dr. Learned?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Bennett. Thank you to the thousands.
Thanks again for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, and thank you all for sharing this time with us. I guess my closing comments would be social distancing is truly the tool we have that is going to help us get through this. And if you get sick, if you get a fever or a cough, isolate yourself and contact your doctor so we can make sure we take good care of you and be safe.
Thank you. Thanks. Greg?
Yes. Thank you again, Senator Bennett, for inviting me to be on this panel. It was wonderful to hear the discussion and the questions that were asked by everyone. I just want to echo Dr. Learned's advice. Please adhere to the stay-at-home orders. That's obviously, as Dr. Learned said, the best tool that we have going right now. I just want to tell everybody to go to reputable websites to get the accurate information on what's going on with COVID-19. There's a lot of information out there that is inaccurate or false, and we want to make sure that everybody's getting the right type of information. So sites like CDC.gov or the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's website are perfect information sites for you to visit. Thanks again.
Hey, Greg Stasinos, could you say those two websites again, just so people have
sure.
It and a little, yeah. little more slowly?
Thanks. Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, the federal website, cdc.gov, G-O-V, is a very good site that has excellent information concerning COVID-19. And then if you just Google in Google or whatever search engine you'd like to use, COVID-19 CDPHE, It'll give you the exact website, the link to our website at the State Health Department.
Terrific. Thank you. Mark Christman?
Yes, thank you all. It's been a pleasure. Definitely, I can't agree with the other panelists more. stay home, you know, keep we need to keep this going. And if you look at the projections, if we really hold the line here, we can turn this thing around and not overwhelm the hospitals, which is the nightmare scenario. You know, CoHealth's number, Greg was referring to the state health webpage. CoHealth's number's on there, as well as 211's a little easier to remember, but you know, ours 303-389-1687. We'd love to get you pointed at the right resources or try to find answers for any of your questions. And so please reach out. Let us know if we can help.
Doreen Peterson?
Yes, thank you, Senator Bennett, for including us. And just know that call center specialists are available right now for people that need assistance. So just dial 211 and people can guide you through how to get the resources that you need, or you can go to the website, which is 211colorado.org, or you can text your zip code to 898-211. But please know that people are there and ready to help you and can guide you in the right directions to any service that you might need across the state of Colorado for human services. Thank you, Senator.
Great. Thank you. I really want to thank our panelists for taking out some time. Every one of these people are enormously busy and are working tirelessly on behalf of all of the citizens of Colorado. So I want to say thank you to that. And I want to say thanks to everybody who took time out to be on this town hall. This is a really hard time for the country, and none of us would have wanted this crisis, but it's here and we have to face it. We've got to continue the social distancing that Dr. Learned and the others talked about, it to answer the question that our kids are asking us, which is, when do we go back to school? To answer the question that small business owners are asking, when do we get to go back to work? We've got to stay distant until we flatten that curve. And I draw a lot of inspiration from other generations of Americans and Coloradans, maybe who haven't gone through exactly the same thing, but have gone through tough things themselves. And I think this is a chance for us, just like those guys, to see it as an opportunity for us to assert our best traditions as Coloradans and as Americans, like so many generations have done before us. And if we do that, which I know we can, I'm confident that we're going to get this country back on our feet. We're going to come out with a stronger future ahead of us, and with Colorado leading the way. So thanks, everybody, for being on the call. I look forward to talking to you soon, and I look forward to seeing you all soon. Goodbye.